when you've got the money in the bank, cash and cash flow are not the same thing. Cash flow moves slowly. Even if you're like Travis here and you can move rents month over month, it's like, let's just say I move rents 20%. It takes a month to collect that rent, and then I get to feel the cash coming in by the time rent's late the following month. At the fastest, you're moving rent every 45 days at the fastest, right? But it typically costs money to make money. You're typically going to have to renovate something or add some value or do something. Cash drains a lot quicker than cash flow increases. Don't be the guy who runs out of cash. Don't be the investor who invests in a deal that runs out of cash, right?
I bought my first house in 2000, and then that went really well. We rented it out before we had, before our mortgage payment was due. So our tenants paid the mortgage the first month. It was great. I was like, we're just going to do this as many times as we can. So we ended up buying over 400 houses over a 4-year period. And, you know, that just kind of, that is managerially intensive in every way. And it's incredibly risky in every way compared to, you know, commercial real estate and compared to several other, pretty much any other asset class you can invest in. And so in 2018, we shut that down. I spent the next 2 years selling off all those houses, about 140 houses or so. And then we jumped right into the self-storage space.
You're listening to the Real Estate Runway podcast, powered by Quattro Capital, where we're all about alternative business and investment strategies to help you amplify life and maximize wealth. Here's your host, Chad, the investment maverick.
All right, all right, all right. Real Estate Runway family, welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Runway podcast. Man, I missed y'all. Y'all haven't missed a beat. You've gotten an episode every week, but I haven't recorded in a month. So it's good to be back on the mic after some travel and all that kind of stuff. I'm really excited to bring an episode to you in the self-storage world today. But before I do, if you get any value out of this show or anything else that Quattro puts out, like it, subscribe it, share it. Just pay it forward, folks. We do this for free. We just give out free education, free, you know, insightful conversations. Just pay it forward and make sure someone else like you hears it. That's how the algorithm works, okay? Without further ado, I'm going to welcome to the show someone we have literally rescheduled with 16 times, I think, between our two calendars. I'm excited to finally have him on the show, Mr. Travis Balcom, founder and CEO of Balcomy Capital in the self-storage space. Travis, welcome to the show. Good to finally have you on, brother.
Yeah, thanks, Chad. Glad to be on.
Good to be on, man. Well, as we typically do, let's start with you, man. I sound like Dr. Seuss this morning. I got to quit the rhymes.
That was nice,
but let's start with you and let's kind of go through, you know, I saw in your bio, you've spent some time running a massive distressed single family home company before getting into self-storage. Walk me through your past history at, you know, pre-real estate, early real estate, and kind of where you are now and why. Let's get that story.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I was right after college. I had a job. It was like 2009. We were selling insulation, or we were trying to sell insulation. It was an insulation trade contractor. And dude, there's no houses being built, nothing going on. And then I found this like little niche of these dudes that were buying houses and renovating them and selling them. And they were just flipping houses. I started taking them out to lunch, asked them how they did that, how they financed it. Slowly, get to the point where I bought my first house in 2012. And then that went really well. We rented it out before we had, before our mortgage payment was due. So our tenants paid the mortgage the first month. It was great. I was like, we're just going to do this as many times as we can. So we ended up buying over 400 houses over a 4-year period. And, you know, that just kind of, that is managerially intensive in every way. And it's incredibly risky in every way compared to, you know, commercial real estate and compared to several other, pretty much any other asset class you can invest in. And so in 2018, we shut that down. I spent the next 2 years selling off all those houses, about 140 houses or so. And then we jumped right into the self-storage space, primarily because going back to my comment, self-storage seemed like the antithesis or the complete opposite of, you know, buying houses like a maniac at 12% hard money loans, you know, buying 10 to 15 of those a month, trying to manage it with 5 staff members. Storage seemed like you could just buy it. People would pay you. It was like this, almost like a gym subscription model, which is where like private equity is coming in. They're always wanting to buy those like subscription model services, the contracts. So we thought it was a good place to put our money, to put our investors' capital, and then after 3 years, it actually is shown to be really, really profitable, a really good investment for us, and we're planning on staying with that one for a while.
I love it. So you basically bought and controlled at some point over 400 houses, and you realize, oh my gosh, how can I get as far away from single individual transactions at the highest possible rates, because they're the smallest possible loans with the highest risk of default. And oh, by the way, every single resident is a pain in my neck, which they're all wonderful people, I'm sure, but they have needs, and they all have different needs, and they all have different homes. And when a toilet breaks, you got to get the right part, not the standard part you have off the shelf. So it sounds like you ran as far as you could from residential real estate back the other direction.
Pretty much. We went from habitable, annoying real estate to non-habitable. Like sometimes I forget where like the address. I actually don't know. I would have to think about the addresses of where my facilities are, because it's not something I think about often. But yeah, we have a management company that manages our facilities, and they, we have one meeting once a month. Outside of that, we're just kind of looking for capital, looking for deals. So it's hard to find right now. But yeah, that's exactly true. We wanted to get as far away from the risk, the stress, and the annoyance of the houses and people bring that live in those houses.
So let's talk a little bit. There's a couple things I want to unpack there, right? So one of which is the I love self-storage, right? I don't do it because I'm an expert in apartments. I'm not set up for it. I want to be one day, right? But there's something to having a niche and being good at that niche before you try to go up to the other. But I love self-storage because while I often say I do unit-based real estate, I don't do square footage-based real estate. Well, self-storage is kind of a marriage of the two, right? It's technically a per square foot type of business, but they're separated into several units, just like an apartment. However, you don't have the regulation, quite the, this isn't someone's primary living condition, right? It's something that they're stuffing things into, maybe a business is using it, things of that sort. So tell me why, in your eyes, and we went through some of that, but in your eyes, why did you kind of gravitate to self-storage over another unit-based commercial asset? The goods about
it. I would say there's probably about five reasons. One, the non-habitable side of things. We're just people, like we have, our facilities are metal and concrete and sometimes asphalt in the drive aisle, a lot of times just gravel. And so like there's, it's really hard to mess that up. And on a given day, we might have 3 to 5 tenants show up, get some stuff and leave, there's just not a lot of wear and tear going on. So the maintenance is, essentially gone. So I would say one, you have very low maintenance. Two, because your maintenance is low, you have very low operating expenses in the multifamily space. Maintenance will make or break you. Like you could literally have a buddy losing a property right now because maintenance just ate him up. And 15-20% of his operating costs are maintenance. It's just terrible. Three, it's a pretty simple business in the sense that you can run it remotely through like a software program. You can choose to have tenants pay automatically through ACH or credit card and require that when you take over a facility, or like you can't really force existing tenants, but you can definitely, when we get new tenants, you're like, you have to pay, we have to have your homeowner's insurance on file, or you have to pay for our insurance. So that makes everything a lot more safer for everybody playing that game. And then two, you have to set up auto draft or, auto credit card drafting. And the reason why is we don't want to be chasing $90, $80. Yeah. Most of our tenants, we have 2,891 tenants right now. And they all but about 10% of them pay less than $100. So twofold. One, it would be annoying to go chase that money. Two, it's such a small amount. Our tenants kind of forget about, that they have it, or that it's not that big of a hassle for them to keep it. So our leases are month to month. Before I got in, that was kind of nerve wracking. But then if you look at the statistics, on our facilities, we have tenants that on average stay over 2.5 years. And that's like the average tenant. We have some tenants on some of these older facilities we buy that have had a unit since I was 6 years old at 1991. You know, it's like they are not going to give up on that sucker. And so it's kind of like an extra attic, extra closet. Like my neighbors in my personal house, they do some of the coolest, like Christmas and Halloween and decorations, all these other decorations, and they keep it at a storage unit. That's like where they keep it all year long. So they're never going to give that up. And so those are a few reasons, but ultimately it's just the ease of receiving money. It's the ease of, you know, paying the mortgage. It's the ease of paying utilities and management services. And then you have a cash flow at the end. There's very few items on the OPEX section of your P&L that really, is surprising. It's pretty much the same thing every week. It's really boring, to be honest.
Hey, boring is okay. That boring equals asymmetric risk, in my opinion. But so
100%.
Yeah, I love that. And so, you know, true or false, right? It seems like when you are, you just mentioned most of your tenants are paying $100 or less, right? Or something in that realm. And so, and your operating expenses are probably pretty low. I'm going to guess if you're acquiring an older storage building, you probably are buying it from a family or a mom and pop operator, probably not a big player. The big players build the 2 and 3 story sexy cube smart stuff, you know, but if you're buying the existing stuff, it's probably coming from a family or a single owner. A lot of them are aging. A lot of them are taking cash payments, as you already alluded to. They may not have systems. They probably don't have a U-Haul, you know, at the center or something like that to generate other revenue. I mean, and if rents are, you know, 40, 50, 60, 80 bucks, you know, moving someone who has had a unit since you were 6 years old, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt and say you're like 21, right? So at the minimum, that's a long time. Okay. So if that's the case, then these people aren't moving their stuff. I mean, you think about if you have an attic you haven't cleaned out in 15 years, what's the likelihood that a 25% rent increase, let's just say you go from $75 to $100, is going to drive you to go and clean that out? So that your ability to move income, true or false, it's a lot easier than other asset classes. And how would you do that? What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, to answer your question, I'm almost 40. Or to respond
I said
to that,
benefit and then, of the doubt. I didn't say I believe.
Yeah,
it,
so. Yeah. And we actually do, but build the 2 and 3 story facilities. We have one going on right now.
Yeah,
but
we build them as well.
A little bit riskier. Okay. But you know, it gets to that. The price point gets to the point where you can. That would bore people. Why we justify doing that? But yeah, most of the properties we buy are from 70-year-old men who are just kind of tired, wanting to retire, or they weren't good at it. Or it's a 45-year-old guy that acts like a 70-year-old man. You know, it's just there's all this stuff. A lot of stubborn rednecks. Most of the stuff we buy in it's in Texas, and so that's probably why. But yeah, the as far as rent increasing, you can absolutely do that, especially if there's not a lot of other options, or if the other options are full as well. We've owned a facility. It was like a collection of facilities in a market, and we were the only ones there, and. You know, the first 20% increase, no one moved out. I'm like, wow, maybe, you know, and it was so low. Like a 10 by 10 was like $40. And like the Texas standard is like 65. So I'm like, we got to get the lease to 65. We got to get to the average. And then, you know, second time we raised another 20%, like about another couple quarters away. And then we had a few people move out. And then the third time we did it, that's when we actually had a few people send us some letters and ask us to stop. But which was great feedback. We don't want to ruin relationships with our tenants. But yeah, on that facility, we raised rents in 1 year to 67%, but they had never been raised ever. And so like they were still paying like 1995 rates. And so we were just, you know, naturally that's how we make money, is increasing rents and adding value. And so, it's, you can definitely add rents. We've had a couple of facilities where we tried to do that and we ended up, getting our butts handed to us and learn a hard lesson. But there's definitely a fine line of being able to raise rents and taking care of your tenants, because they will just leave, especially our RV and boat facilities. If all they have to do is go hook up their boat and get it out of there, they're going to do it. And they're probably going to give you a shitty review about it, because you raise their rents 10% or whatever. It's never justifiable. The reviews and the money that we're getting extra, or their frustration, is never justifiably, you know, accurate or whatever. But But yeah, it's very easy to raise rents. You can, like I mentioned, we'd raise rent 67% 1 year on one facility. And that's a lot different than multifamily. That'll take you a good 3 years to even raise, you know, because you get lease renewals at least. And so it'll take a long time. Yeah. I would say the main difference is multifamily. You get a lot more money coming in as opposed to, even a big storage facility has a lot less money coming in than like a 100-unit apartment complex. And so, but other than that, yes, it's outside of the revenue, dollar amount, then yeah, it's very easy to raise rents, very easy to add value. You can double the value of a storage facility pretty dang quick.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, as of this recording, I was trying to get back to the mute button. I was just looking it up to confirm my stat. Average rent in the US for an apartment unit, just blended average, everything new, everything old, everything busted, everything in the middle, is $1,700 around the whole US, right? So that average rent for the self-storage unit, blending the average, is what would you say that is, including all the new stuff,
even the Class C crap? I would say I think Extra Space has an average of $135 a unit.
Okay. So, yeah. So we're somewhere
extra space
between
is a massive Class A.
Yeah, you mentioned the average of the old stuff is about $65 in Texas and the new stuff. So it is a much higher revenue unit. And we just articulated, I guess the biggest distinction to me, Travis, is with an apartment, you're messing with someone's livelihood, right? So if they don't pay you, you have the right to regain possession of that unit. And for the most part, with the exception of certain demographics, that's not going to happen. They're usually not going to let that happen because that's their place of domicile. And what's interesting is there are also a lot more landlord-tenant laws, because if you evict someone, you technically are putting them on the street, and they may not have the credit or the wherewithal to go get another place with an eviction on their record. So that's a really big deal. What's interesting about the self-storage world is there's really not as much, tell me if I'm wrong here, but there's really not as much law and order. There's a process, but it's not going to be near as much of a, publicity issue or anything if you had to remove some residents for non-payment. And I think it's as easy as putting their stuff out on the lawn, but typically they're not going to let that happen, right? So do you see that as a risk? Then it's not it's not the first check you write,
Yeah, I don't see it as a risk. With apartments, you have, HUD essentially governs apartments, yeah. Because they're trying to take care of sweet low-income people that actually need it, that don't know
the ins and outs of the legality of things. Basic human need, right?
So, but whereas storage is a commodity business, right? It's like you don't really need storage. And so you don't have to go through judicial evictions. You just post in the newspaper a couple of times, and then you can schedule an auction. And then, you never really get any money from the auction. It's just someone goes in and buys it and cleans it out for you. And then you can put a new tenant in there. And that's the whole goal, is just to get a free unit or get the unit freed up so you can rent it out again. And I don't think we did, man, I could be wrong, but I think we did less than 10 evictions last year in 2023. So, we tend to, they tend to end up paying or coming up with some sort of agreement. And we don't want to kick anybody's out or kick their stuff out. That's a big waste of time for everybody. We'd rather just take their money and let them use our 10x10 as a service. So
yeah, that makes sense. Well, overall, I agree with you. I love the asset class. It's a low headache, low OPEX, lower income, but probably more consistent margin, and the ability to, when you find the right deal, there's really a great ability to move that net operating income, which equates to profits and wealth generation for you, the investor. So tell me, let's kind of transition the show a little bit, and let's talk about how in the self-storage world, I'm talking to you as an investor, as someone who's probably wanting to put some money to work with a reputable operator. How do I know that your deals are, you're finding deals in the right way that have the meat on the bone or the opportunity to either increase the revenues or provide a stable revenue generation? How do you go about that? And what's the right, what should I be looking for if I'm an investor?
Sure, right? Sure. Well, I would say Balcomi Capital's, 12-year internal rate of return averages 23.59. And so it's very high. And a lot of that, that's actually, went, like our, the storage, full cycle storage deals that we've had actually are higher than that. So that included some of the residential stuff there. As far as like investing and choosing to invest, you know, storage has the lowest default rate of any asset class in the commercial real estate sector. In addition to that, they've withstand the last three recessions better than any other asset class has. So by putting your money in storage, you're actually going to be, you know, keeping your money a lot safer than if you put it somewhere else. With that said, it's always good to diversify. It's always good to put it in, you know, multifamily, that sort of thing. I wouldn't put anything into anything other than storage right now. Multifamily seems scary. There's a lot. Office seems super scary. Retail seems slightly scary. Seems like there's some sort of distress in every commercial asset sector except storage. Even the deals that I see that I would say are distressed, like they're actually still paying their mortgage. And so, you know, they're like a lease up deal or, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, generally speaking, most of these work out. You know, it's very rare that you get an REO that it doesn't work out. It's because a lot of it, it's like you can run it so streamlined without a lot of ups and downs that it's just, you can kind of predict what's going to happen, right? We have a property that caught on fire last year. And so we lost a good amount of tenants. Well, we're rebuilding that right now, but we do feel like that next 40% that is empty right now, that's getting rebuilt, is going to be, you know, it's going to get full before the end of the year. And just based off of our lease up averages in that market. And so ultimately, you know, I guess to conclude or whatever, it's the best place to put your money right now is self storage. And it's kind of always been, it's just been kind of a sleepy asset that no one's ever really paid attention to. And it also really is boring. Like you can't like get really excited about the storage. Just a metal building. It looks ugly. Everyone thinks it's ugly. Everyone knows it's a commodity. Most Americans are like, we should just rather throw that stuff away, but they don't. They keep it. So that's what I would say. But yeah, generally speaking, our, you know, prefs are 8 to 10% higher than most asset classes. We tend to get our investors' money back within 28 to 36 months, and then we have a runway of another 2 years to sell. And so, That's kind of how I would answer that question. So.
Yeah, Travis. And just, you know, listeners, just to offer current market information to you as well, you know, I like to make sure whenever we express opinions, we also moderate with data. You know, when you quote CoStar, Yardi Matrix, and I'm thinking of a RealPage article right now specifically, office does still have quite a bit of distress. And why is that? Supply and demand still does not match up to pre-pandemic levels. And interestingly, office has always been a highly institutionalized asset. And therefore, if it isn't running at higher than 90-93%, it's typically losing money. Okay. So the problem is we're still seeing occupancies down in the 70s and 80s, in some cases worse. You're going to continue to see distress in the office market until supply regains with demand. Now, do keep an eye. You're starting to see some cities being amenable, like New York City, for example, will typically lead on things like this. They're converting a lot of these vacant office buildings to living that is also needed. So apartment conversions, those are going to be real expensive and real risky to the first few people who figure it out with infrastructure, but that is actually happening. Retail is actually coming out the last two or three quarters. Retail's looking pretty good. It's not sexy. It's not going to be somewhere I'm like, wow, that's a strong buy right now, but it's not dangerous. You know, especially with core CPI or core PCE and CPI trending the way that it is with the Fed's actions, retail has actually, you know, our overall GDP is actually producing pretty well. I mean, it was 2.7% last year, despite all expectations. So retail is not a bad investment, but don't expect the strongest growth out of it right now. And then you come to multifamily. Of course, there has been isolated distress, and the biggest problem has been debt driven. Typically, we haven't really seen increases in resident defaults or decreases in rental rates at a macro scale. At least at the top, it is the luxury stuff. But you are seeing some distress in isolated cases where borrowers got over their skis and borrowed too high and the rates turned on them and now they're stuck. So there is going to be some of that, but we still haven't seen the wave of defaults that we've been looking for, you know, licking our chops. So anyway, coming back to the conversation, Travis, We talked through kind of what your deals feature. How are you? You mentioned you're building some of these newer luxury self storage. So how are you acquiring the ones that you're acquiring, the older ones, and what is that archetype? And how are you? What qualifies to you as a good build location over an acquisition? Right.
Sure. We do single asset syndications for all of our facilities, and so when we get a facility. Yeah. Under contract, we're raising money just for that facility. We typically are using a local bank loan here. We've tried to work with brokers. They just tend to not understand. Timelines would be the best way to communicate that. They know how to get a loan, but the timeline is you get the broker and you get the... Yeah, so we just use a local bank here. Rates are a little higher than they normally would be. Then we're typically putting 25% down, and then, we keep 12 months of reserves, of mortgage payment reserves. So if the mortgage payment is 20 grand, we're going to put 240 grand to a reserve account just in case of a cloudy day, happens, which rarely happens in self storage. But, so that's how we buy existing facilities. We've been throwing out some letter of intents with owner financing tied to it, but those aren't getting accepted. Like I mentioned, I don't know if we were recording when I mentioned this, but we're certainly in a gap period throughout the entire, real estate industry. Sellers want one price, aren't going to budge. Buyers can buy at another price, aren't going to budge. And then that typically normally involves a spread of several million dollars. And so,
yeah.
As far as developing is really, it was a lot of development that went on in 2021 or started in 2021 because rates and steel prices, basically rates skyrocketed and steel prices stayed the same, and then residential building material prices actually skyrocketed as well. So a lot of house flippers were like, we're just going to build storage. That's caused I think that's caused some issues. Those are selling for cost or a little bit less than what they had in them. There's a huge player in Texas that has 19 facilities that are all listed. None of them are cash flowing. They have seven, but we have one here in our local market of that brand, and there's seven tenants. It's like that guy's in a pickle. But ultimately what we do is we want to look at a facility, or we want to look at a market that is growing, that is outside of a major market. So no primary market, probably secondary market would be a good term for that. Then we want to make sure there's enough demand. So demand is calculated a lot of different ways. It would be, there's really no definitive way to really figure out demand outside of just calling all the other facilities and asking them what their rates are and if they're full and that sort of thing. The one we're building right now, we have a facility that the only other climate control is on the other side of the town, and it's always full. I know the owner, he says it's his best asset of 47 facilities. So we are going to put on the opposite side, we're going to put a similar 44,000 net rentable square foot climate control facility. In that market, there's a crap ton of storage, right? But it's all non-climate control. It was all built in the 80s and 90s. It's behind auto dealerships or behind pawn shops. There's no real professional quality facility in that market except my buddies that I was just mentioning. And so we feel like there's a great opportunity there. We're still working the permit process on that, but we should be, I would say, probably by April or June working on that. It's pretty cut and dry. It's a 14-month process to build, and then it takes about 28 to 36 months to fill up, and then you can refinance and get your money out. So it's a little longer of a play. You're looking for those investors that are okay having their money tied up for 3 to 4 years, and then okay being in a deal for 7 years as opposed to 4 or 5, like our existing facilities. You also don't get the same tax benefits up front. You eventually do the second or third year when you're actually taking tenants in, you're not able to do a cost seg at that first year because you're still building it. But other than that, that's pretty much the only negative. You have a brand new asset. If you build it a certain way, a certain size, in a certain location, you have a very strong chance that when you are done and you're wanting to exit, a private REIT or a public REIT will buy that as opposed to some just kind of mom and pop guy small company to buy it. So
another value add player. Yeah. And don't look over that, folks. I mean, you have to always be playing with the end in mind. And we kind of do that as well. It's like the assets we're targeting are, okay, I can sell that to a publicly traded thing. right? Which is a REIT or a, you know, institution of some sort, rather than just another player like me. That's a huge plus in any asset you go in. And so Travis, last question before we get to our quattro questions here at the end. I'm an investor. I'm looking at self-storage deals. Help me understand, what should I be looking for in the underwriting and the deal presentation? Like, how do I discern a pretty deal package that's not really going to live up to expectations versus this looks like a pretty good buy in this time? What do you think?
Yeah, honestly, it comes down to a few things. One, before I mention those, there's a lot of, like I mentioned, there's kind of a lot of house flippers right now trying to be storage guys. It's because they couldn't find houses, so let's go flip, let's go build storage stuff. Timeline is a huge one. So I saw a brand new facility offering memorandum, they haven't even broke ground yet, and they're saying that like within 36 months, they will have their money back to their investors. And I mean, you guys are going to be like at like 30% occupancy at 36 months. And so that's a real important thing, making sure you have a tried and true operator, or if he's not an operator anymore, like I don't really consider myself an operator because we have a manager. I know how to operate them, but I don't have like, we use a management company now. We just raise money, but you want to make sure the person that is doing it has enough history and understanding of the timeline that really happens. Because the thing about multifamily is you can finish a brand new complex, and when their lease is up somewhere else, they're like, man, I want to move to that new place because that thing has a pool, has like, you know, has like awnings, it has a resort style pool, and it's right next to the river.
Golf simulator, like all the cool things.
Yeah, exactly. But with the, or in a Starbucks, but like, a storage facility, again, is a commodity. No, that thing is going to take 3 years to fill up. You're going to have a net absorption rate of 3%. And if you're above that, you're actually beating the market. And so if you have 6% net absorption, you're actually getting twice as many people into there as than most people, other people will. So that's really important. So you need to have a timeline on brand new facilities. You need to have a timeline of at least a year to build. If they have permits at hand, it'll be at least a year to build and then 36 months to fill up. So you're not going to get your money for 4 years. If you're buying an existing facility, that changes a little bit because it depends. Like our first facility was the one that we bought. You know, we paid $2 million for it. We increased rent 67% that first year, and it was worth like $3.5 million you know, within 15 months. So we like almost doubled the value. And so we were able to get our investors' capital back a lot faster than, you know, if we had just kind of slow playing it and bought something at market rate. But that was kind of a different thing because you could buy that one, and I knew I could increase rates, I knew I could cut expenses, and I knew that would equal adding a ton of value. And so, but if you're looking at a deal, you want everything needs to be kind of normal looking, right? If they're offering a 30% internal rate of return, they don't know how to math very well. And then if it's filling up too fast, they also don't know how to math very well. And then if they don't have a consideration for CapEx up front and reserves, then it's a risky endeavor because they will probably use the money for the new sign. They'll probably use the investing capital for the gate fixing. And then, you know, some of these things, you raise rents and you have a surprise. Like everyone, like you raise rents, you're like, this is great. And then everyone leaves to the new facility down the street that's doing 3 months free or whatever. And you're like, oh, geez. And then if you don't have the reserves, that's important. We have not ever had to use our reserves yet. But they help me sleep at night, and it should help investors sleep at night because we over raise for our deal. It lowers the basis point, return a little bit, or the return is lower, but just a few basis points. But at the same time, we know that we're never going to have a situation of where we're having to call our investors for money.
Let me just decode what he said there, because he said it like a pro, but I want you guys to hear how important that is. Would you rather have case A, where I say I'm going to give you a 23% IRR, but I'm going to raise only just enough cash for all the line items that I have? I have no reserves. Which means I'm at risk of, if anything goes wrong, I'm going to have to come back and say, hey guys, I need more money, or I got to hold your distributions for 6 months and build my reservations back up, or my reserves back up. Or would you rather case B, where I say, hey, I'm going to give you a 19 IRR, but I've got enough cash to weather like 25% margin on everything I'm saying we're going to do, because you just have unknown unknowns, right? On one hand, they're both great returns. One of them you're going to be a lot more frustrated with when you have to either cough up more money or be like, wait, why are my distributions that I just got used to stopping for 6 months? You know, it's like what people don't often understand, and this is especially true of young operators. And look, when I was a young operator, I got hit with this too. If you bookkeep everything and raise money for everything you know you're going to need, right? But in every negotiation, in every deal, in every life situation, you have your known knowns, you have your known unknowns, and you have your unknown unknowns. And guess what? Number three is what bites you in the ass and comes back and says, oh, I should have raised an extra $250,000 for something I didn't think about, right? When you've got the money in the bank, cash and cash flow are not the same thing. Cash flow moves slowly. Even if you're like Travis here and you can move rents month over month, it's like, let's just say I move rents 20%. It takes a month to collect that rent, and then I get to feel the cash coming in by the time rent's late the following month. At the fastest, you're moving rent every 45 days at the fastest, right? But it typically costs money to make money. You're typically going to have to renovate something or add some value or do something. Cash drains a lot quicker than cash flow increases. Don't be the guy who runs out of cash. Don't be the investor who invests in a deal that runs out of cash. All right. So Travis, awesome conversation. Let's flip over to the Quattro questions, get to know you a little more on the personal level. You ready?
Yeah.
All right, man. Give me your superpower. Could be life or business, and just tell me how it serves you well.
Yeah, I feel like no matter how I respond on that, it's going to come off really egotistical. But, you know, I would say in business, I'm really good at doing numbers in my head, really understanding how the numbers are going to work. That's done well on for us personally and for investors. I would say in life, I'm a huge relationship person. I want to get to know you. I want to know all my investors. I want to know all the people in my co-working spot here, even though they don't want to know me sometimes. And I would say I'm just really relational. I tend to remember things about people. And then I think that goes well for me.
Relationships and reputation are all you have in life, folks. Remember that. Write that down. Let's flip the coin over. What is your biggest failure? Could be life or business. And most importantly, what did you take away from?
Yeah, I would say growing that house flipping business too fast was probably a pretty big failure. I say it's a failure, but we were still buying correctly. We were just buying with very little cash. Going back to our comments earlier, why I now have a ton of reserves. And we were just buying and buying and buying, and then we weren't able to dispose of them quickly enough, and so we just kind of ran out of cash. And I let five people that I really cared about go in one day because it was going to take another 45 days to get enough money to cover payroll. And so, it was just sloppy, man. So we would buy them, we would be renovating them, and we didn't really know where the, where did the money go for that deal? It's like sort of thing. And in 2018, we bought 91 houses in 10 months. And so, there was a lot of sloppiness, a lot of, petty lawsuits that came about because of that sloppiness. And what I learned is that wealth can't wait, but it also takes time. And so you can just be methodical. If you rush into something, you're more than likely going to make more mistakes than if you take your time and really kind of scope out the land before you kind of move forward.
Big lessons there, folks. If you grow fast, cancer grows fast too. So if you are not well while you're growing, the cancer is going to get bigger. And what that turns into is if you're not building systems and processes to templatize what you're doing and know where money's going or be able to have the right puzzle pieces to put together, guess what? Cash moves faster than cash flow. Any business, when you run out of cash, doesn't matter how good your profit and loss statement is. If you're out of cash, you're out of cash. So very important lesson there. Let's flip to question number three. So I love to give everyone a chance for like a, shameless plug, podcast, book, gift, anything you have that you'd like to share with the audience here. Do it now.
As far as a shameless plug, I didn't catch that. I'm sorry. I didn't catch what you just said.
Yeah, it could be shameless plug, podcast, free gift, anything you like to, share with the audience.
Sure. Our website is Invest in Storage Deals. You can definitely go there, fill out a little form. You'll get the next deal that we have coming out. I highly recommend any book by Ryan Holiday. When my house flip business kind of fell apart, I started reading The Obstacle Is the Way. And like right after that, then COVID hit and I read it again. I ended up reading it like 37 times. And so, a lot of it's about, it's light stoicism. It basically communicates stoicism in a way that people understand it. And stoicism is basically an objective way to look at life. Like, yeah, okay, I had to fire everybody, but is that the end of things for me? Like, no, it's not. Actually, I'm going to get out of this and I'm going to commit to getting out of this. The only way you can get out of this is by going through it. So, I highly recommend any of his books, and then no free gifts at this point. So,
well, I will have to second The Obstacle Is the Way. And I think it's incredibly ironic that you just said that, because one of my coaches gave me a recorded summary version of that I listened to for the first time just this morning in about 45 minutes, probably 2 hours ago. So incredibly hilarious that you brought that up.
Yeah.
Great book. The Obstacle Is the Way. There's summary versions out there, but I think it's Millionaire Mindset or something like that does summaries. But also I recommend you listen to the full book, get all the details, stuff like that. So last question. Here at Quattro, one of our four pillars is philanthropy. They are people, property, profits, and philanthropy. A group of people coming together around a property to generate a profit, some of which is used for philanthropy, coming back and taking care of people. So I love to give my guests an opportunity just to share what's on your heart. You know, where do you give your time, your talents, your treasures? You know, what causes do you support? A lot of times people will join in and support on your behalf. And I've seen that in the comments before. So what's that for you?
Yeah, I would say, I'll probably break it down too. My wife started a school 5 years ago for like entrepreneurship and STEM, that sort of thing. We give a lot of our money to that. She's no longer like actively working in that school. We have a headmaster and that sort of thing. It's doing a great job, but that's where most of our money goes. Most of our time goes there as well. Most of the free time we have goes there. Great place, such a unique school. Kids, man, it is so amazing to see something my wife started, you know, and these sweet little kids, just becoming who they are in life. And so, and watching that is just pretty incredible.
I love that, man. I don't think there's any more noble way to spend time, money, and talents than pouring into young kids who can't really control the hand they were dealt, but they can sure as hell change it with the right tools. So I love that, brother. Travis, thank you for coming on, sharing some of your knowledge about both development and acquisition of self-storage properties. Man, hope to do this again soon, and maybe we'll chat in a few months about how the market tides are turning as the Fed starts loosening credit later this year. So appreciate you being on, man.
That'd be great. Yeah, man, appreciate it. Chad, thanks.
All right, everyone, this has been another episode of the Real Estate Runway Podcast. Remember, if you got any value out of this show, like, subscribe, share, pay it forward, folks. This is free content. It only grows when you share it. Appreciate the heck out of you. And until next time, over and out.
We hope this episode was insightful and brought value to your day. If so, please be awesome and leave us a 5-star review. Find out how Team Quattro can help you at thequattroway.com and scroll down for more info. Until next time, this is the Real Estate Runway Podcast.